your fault. Maybe it's not mine. Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Right smack dab in the middle of it. Right smack dab in the middle. We are right smack dab.
Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with Charlotte Littlefield, and she's having some technical difficulties out of Missouri. Welcome back to our program, Satyajit Das.
You're getting better with my name, George.
All right. I might make it. Hey,
you might make it indeed.
Yeah, tell our listening audience that has joined us for this second hour about your Traders, Guns, and Money. And you're the author of Traders, Guns, and Money, Knowns and Unknowns in the Dazzling World of Derivatives. Tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words.
Well, I was born in Calcutta in India. My parents emigrated to Australia in 1970. I was 12 years old, and I've lived in Australia for 40 years. And I trained as a lawyer and an accountant, which were two completely useless things, so I went on to do a third useless thing, which is I became a banker. And I spent about 10 years or so working in different banks like Merrill Lynch and Citigroup, and then I went and worked in a company. I thought it'd be good to go and work somewhere where they did real things, assisting from financial things. And I have been a consultant to companies and banks and so forth because it's a strange thing that I know a little bit about, which is a strange, weird world of derivatives. And the book came about for a really weird reason because nobody, including my family and my friends and so forth, really understand what I do. So I decided when I was getting towards the end of my life that I wanted to write something which set out what I did. And that's how Traders came about, which I thought would have an audience of about four. That turned out to be quite successful, and it sold around the world for reasons which I can't actually describe. I just think this whole area is such an arcane area, I didn't think anybody would be interested. And also it happened to coincide with the global financial crisis in which derivatives had a small role. And so, you know, it's done a little better than I thought it would. But it's kind of fun, and I've had a very lucky life in that way. And so here I am talking to you, George.
Right. I appreciate that, Dan. What's interesting about this is that you can say the negative of derivatives, but in a nice way. You know what I mean? I mean,
well,
some people
when the book came out,
cannot express the negative in a very good way, if you know what I'm saying, but you can, you know?
Well, I think one of the funniest things is when the book came out, well, all my former derivatives colleagues and so forth in the banking business looked at me with horror. And the horror was mixed with one of two things. One is that I'd let the cat out of the bag. But they're quite arrogant. They're a bunch of very arrogant people, so they didn't really care. They thought nobody would really care about what they did. But the funniest one was there are a lot of anecdotes in the books which are actually drawn from real life. But to protect the guilty and also protect myself from being shot, I disguised the name. But I have this strange phenomenon when people would say to me things like, "Now I'm that character, aren't I? I'm that character, aren't I?" And I said, "Well, I can't confirm or deny that, but I'm absolutely astonished at your vanity at assuming that you were important enough to be that character. So if you want to be that character, feel free to be that character."
So everybody, a lot of your friends thought they were in the book, and some were and some weren't, right?
That's right. That's right.
Well, you know, what I found, too, is that, you know, the world is a strange place sometimes, and if you can't find a little humor in it, it's a long life to live, you know? But with a little humor, it makes things more palatable and much happier life, I think. What do you think?
I think so, too. And I think, you know, there's something weird. When I first went to work in this weird world of derivatives, you know, the word derivative didn't exist. There were things like futures and options. And I bluffed my way into that world because I really didn't want to do what I was doing at that stage. And somebody said there's an opportunity in working in this area. So I sort of read up a little bit about it, and I just bluffed my way into this. And I still find it considerably humorous that my employers trusted a 20-something-year-old who didn't really know very much and probably still doesn't know very much. But basically, they trusted me with initially millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. And I find it's still an extraordinary process, and I imagine it still goes on.
Right. Have you spent much time in London and in the city where all the big money and the big money powers office up
yes.
there? Have you spent a little time around there? What do you, tell us about the city of London.
Well, the city of London's a fascinating place. I mean, the so-called city is just a kind of weird place. It's actually, the name the city comes because it's like about a square mile. But it's
yeah.
really very, very decrepit. It's in places like Lombard Street and Cornhill, which are basically old sort of trade districts in which in the 18th century people started to sell stocks and securities and so forth. And it was quite interesting. Most of those stocks they sold were things like the South Sea Bubble Company, which came to a very sad end. So it was really a hotbed of speculation. And over the years, the city became synonymous with money. And one of the really weird things about England is there is England, as you know, was once a great world power, and it was a power built on an astonishing military prowess, particularly their navy, and also a tremendous capacity to trade. And they traded everything, and they really, if you look at it, controlled the bulk of the world. The strange thing is if you go to England today, it's basically a financial center. They trade money. That's all they do. I mean, there's a bit of other things, obviously, but it's basically money. And the city is this tiny part with its quaint traditions and so forth, and that almost dominates the world. And obviously, at the moment, the big concern is that if the financial services industry becomes less and less important in the world, London will suffer. And this is why the English government have been so far terribly, terribly resistant to anything that would reduce the importance of finance. Because something like probably 10 to 15%, maybe even more, of the British economy relies on finance. But also the other thing which is really, really weird about London is we talk about the city just as we talk about Wall Street in New York. But basically, it's not really the city anymore because the city itself obviously exists. But there are two other centers in London. One is Canary Wharf, which was the creation of a very, very strange gentleman called Michel von Klemm, who I actually worked for at one stage in my life. And Michel von Klemm basically looked at the old East India docks. This is where the great merchant ships of the English naval empire went out and got goods and brought them back for trading and so forth. That they'd become run down in the 1950s and 60s because England really no longer had the dominant position in that sort of trade. And he redeveloped that into a financial center, which is known as Canary Wharf now. And actually, it's quite interesting. All the, particularly the American banks, preferred to go to Canary Wharf, which was newer and more modern, whereas the traditional English banks preferred the city, though that sort of alternates. And there's a third center, which is around Mayfair, which is a very trendy part of London, where all the hedge funds and so forth basically congregate. And they're centered around a part of London, which is around Berkeley Square. And Berkeley Square, some of your listeners will remember, was made famous by a wartime song, which was The Nightingale in Berkeley Square, sung by Vera Lynn. And I tell you what, there are no nightingales, but I think there's a heck of a lot of hedge funds and a lot of money. We actually call that Hedge Fund Alley. It's got to change. London's changed enormously over the years.
Man, I tell you, London is quite a place. I was over there in 2006, and I saw it for myself, and just bigger than life. The statues are bigger than life, everything, the buildings and everything. It's just a city that most people should at least go to once in their life. We're going to be leaving for another break. Can you join us with another segment, or do you have to leave us?
No, I can stay. But if you go to London, George, always check the plumbing, I always say.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with Charlotte Littlefield, who's got some technical difficulty. Welcome back, Dan.
Nice to be with you, Jerk.
Satya Jit stands for Truthful Winner, and that's absolutely what you are,
in my opinion.
Well, it's very, very kind. You've done your research, obviously, in terms of what my name means.
Well, a little bit, because your parents couldn't have named you better than they did, because you truly stand on truth. And in looking at all this financial, you know, quagmire, you do stand out as an individual that stands on truth.
Well, my parents brought me up the right way, let's put it that way.
You must have some wonderful parents. That's what I think. Anyway.
Oh, thank you very much.
So anyway, what's going on in the world today? We've got those protests that just happened in London on the tuition. We've had the previous in Paris. They were protesting, and there's been, a global warming thing up there in the forests of Germany. What's going on out there? Are we seeing a lot of problems, social problems that are coming up?
Well, I think it has a lot of drivers, obviously. It's not never any one thing. But I think fundamentally one of the things that's happening is that the financial problems that we've been talking about have flowed through into a social dimension. And let's come back a stage. I mean, it's all very well to say that the Greeks didn't work very hard and got all these extra benefits and so forth. But the reality is that now they're being asked to make horrendous sacrifices. And the average person in Greece, and I'm not talking about the rich, but the average person in Greece who's not rich is basically getting their pensions and all their entitlements and their income slashed by 30 or 40%. And why that's happening is simply this. Now, during the global financial crisis, as we were talking earlier, the problem goes back to that there's just too much debt in the world. And when that all blew up, because everybody realized that basically you couldn't pay back all this debt, the government stepped in. Now, this is like one of those wonderful, wonderful games of pass the parcel. Originally, the companies had a lot of debt, then they passed it to the individual, particularly from the 1990s onwards, but particularly in the United States, post about the early 2000s. Now what's happening is the government stepped in, so they sort of took the parcel off the individual. The problem is the government's now have nobody to pass it to. Because governments, people overestimate the power of governments, because basically all governments can do is either borrow money and spend money or tax and spend money. And so what's actually happening now, particularly in Europe, and I think Europe is a very, very good canary in the coal mine of what's going to happen around the world, is the governments are going to have to cut back on their spending, which basically means one of two things, raise taxes or cut back on your spending. And so basically what we're seeing is this massive cutback in terms of spending in places like England, and the riots you were talking about in England related to cutback in student benefits. But in places like Ireland, you know, you're seeing massive cutback in benefits at a time when unemployment in Ireland is like 15 to 20%. And, you know, people are now living in great fear of, firstly, their quality of life, but leaving aside quality of life, it's about their survival, about their children's future, about their ability to eat and have a reasonable standard of living. And I'm not talking about being rich. I'm just having a reasonable standard of living in their retirement. I mean, people don't talk about this, but when the Irish bailout was done, effectively, the Irish government was forced to use about $17 billion of really what is loosely, it's not exactly, but it's loosely money that Ireland had, which could have funded state pensions. It was like seizing that. And all of that is going to lead to massive, massive social unrest. And I think that is what we're going to see. So I think, you know, history is a funny thing. We look at the last 60 or so years and think, you know, this period of great stability, you know, relative social harmony, all of that was the norm. Now, if you look at history, that type of stability is not the norm. It's a far more fractious sort of world we live in. And some of those things are now coming back. Now, whether this is permanent or this is a temporary phenomenon, I don't know. But I think we're going to see a lot of noise around that. And people will see changes in government and a lot of political and social instability. And at the end of the day, there are only three great savings nations in the world, in my view, which is some of the Asian nations, which is China is the major one. There's also Japan, and there's Germany. And there's also obviously the oil-rich countries, which is not really that they're savers, it's just they have this oil wealth. And essentially they're not going to have to basically put their hands in their pockets and bail out the rest of the world. And I can't speak for the Asians and the Middle East, but the Germans certainly are having second thoughts about bailing out their European brothers and sisters. And, you know, essentially there was a headline in Germany which is quite funny, which is in one of their tabloid newspapers called Bild, which basically said, Germans, the idiots of Europe, simply because they were bailing out everybody. And there's going to be huge political and social outcomes from that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Germans, Merkel has been very reluctant about coming forward with bailout money. But what the Germans couldn't do through war, it looks like they're trying to do financially and economically, is dominate Europe. Is that what's going on? Or has been?
Well, I think, look, the war was the war, and that's a very, very complex series of social phenomenon. But one thing which is not beyond the realms of sort of relevance here is the tragedy, which was the Great Depression and the early 1930s and late 1920s, created conditions in Germany which saw the rise of fascist powers. Now, I'm not for a second suggesting that's going to be repeated, but it was those types of social conditions. And I remember Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s saying that, you know, if people are out of work, people are in financially straitened circumstances and have no hope, they turn to other remedies. But I think fundamentally, I think if you look at Germany, Germany has benefited and is also paying the cost of the European experiment. They've benefited because a weak euro benefits some of their industries. Also, the common market has benefited Germany because they're very efficient. They make certain things very well. They're an old-style economy. They make things. They've done very well. But at the same time, they've had to pay a lot to support other members. And I think the two of those are now in competition. And to be honest, I don't know how the German people will ultimately react. But, you know, I was in Europe a little earlier this month, and the general feeling is in Europe, particularly in Germany, is that they deeply resent having to pay for the rest of Europe because they're a very thrifty, very hardworking race, and they don't see why they have to bear the cost of others' profligacy, I guess.
Right. A friend of mine who's an often guest on my program, Bob Chapman, says that European Union just is too diverse to come together as a solidarity union. He thinks that all the cultures and languages are operating in such a way to continue to be a divisive factor and not a unifying thing. What do you think?
Well, I think the European Union is often misunderstood. While it's economic, its purpose was very clear. I mean, the purpose is basically to prevent World War III. Because if you look through history, most of the world wars in Europe were essentially between France and Germany or various agglomerations of them. So I think fundamentally the European Union was designed to avoid the political devastation and the social and obviously economic devastation of war. Now, over time, it's become a very useful economic tool.
Right. Can you come back for another segment? We got to take a break. Can you come back for another
one? No problem. I'll come back and we can explore this further. No problems.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Welcome back, Dash, to our program.
Nice to be with you again, George.
Yeah. Where were we when we went on break there?
Well, we were talking about the differences within the European Union and the different countries.
Yes.
And you're quite correct, as I was saying. It's really a political decision to prevent the breakout of World War III. And the economic part of it, which has been labeled on top of that, has huge problems because the economies are different, they're different structures, and they have huge differences in living standards. And as you correctly point out, laid on top of that, it's deep-seated cultural divisions. Now, to be very honest, despite that, it's worked quite well for the last 30 or 40 years, and the common currency certainly for the last 10 years has sort of muddled along. But I think what the recent problems are doing is exposing fairly deep-seated issues that have to be dealt with. And I think there's also a deep-seated problem in the European Union because most of the countries effectively send off their politicians who, for any reason, they want to send to an exile to the European Union. So, for instance, we have Manuel Barroso, who's now a very senior functionary in the European Union, but he was basically sent off because, you know, the Portuguese, his party didn't want him, and he'd lost the election, da-da-da-da-da. And so, basically, you have this whole bunch of what I call Eurocrats, and the Eurocrats basically have only one interest, which is basically perpetuating their own existence. So it's a rather complicated sort of structure, and the other thing I do know is getting that many countries to decide anything is never easy. And I think what the current crisis in Europe is doing is basically throwing all of that into very sharp relief. And under those circumstances, it's going to be deeply, deeply troublesome for seeing how they're going to muddle their way out. But I think it's like everything in Europe, you know, it's going to take a long time. As it's going to be an epic breakup. If they do break up, it'll take 10 or 20 years for them to break up. They don't like doing things quickly.
Right. The European Union, it was a model. Many Americans are afraid. We have a North American Union that was being put forward by George W. Bush here. And many other people here in America are afraid that America's constitution is going to be overlaid by some umbrella, see. And so that's a real danger. And so we're forever on guard about things like that. But getting back to the European Union is that these carbon trading securities and so forth. What's your view on those carbon trading securities, especially in the Lord Mockton is exposing this global climate change or global warming to be a bit of a fraud. What are your views on that?
Look, the climate change issue is a very complex one, and realistically, human beings always believe they have the answer and the knowledge, but the Earth is a very complex creature. However, I have to say I come out on the side of people who think that human beings have had a not necessarily very positive impact on the environment. That would be my first position. That said, and I think that's just normal common sense, which says, you know, you have 6 billion people on the planet, and I don't think the planet was quite designed for what we're now doing. But leave that to one side. You can be a climate change skeptic or a climate change believer, but I think there's some issues there. Then the next question is that if you look very, very carefully at the scheme which is being put forward, which is the carbon trading, and, you know, you've got to be very clear about what carbon trading is. You just put a price on carbon. And so basically everybody who emits carbon has to pay a price. There's nothing in principle wrong with that, but there are other ways of dealing with it which would be far, far more effective. And the carbon trading system is a system designed by banks and financial institutions, which would obviously give them a very lucrative role in that. And I'm not sure that's necessarily an unmitigated good. And that's my major problem with it. The other thing is, I think fundamentally, the whole issue about climate has some parallels with basically the problems with debt, because there's some similarities. If you actually look at debt, what do? We have instant gratification. We borrow from the future to spend today. And the problem is what we can do is we can push all our problems into the future. And, you know, in the Botox economy, we keep doing that as well. And in the climate change problem, we're trying to do the same thing because we produce things, there are some toxic emissions, which come down the track. So it's more of a cultural issue of how, as a society, as a planet, we deal with this problem of trying to defer problems further and further into the future, because eventually the future becomes today and it catches up with you. And so I'm not greatly in favor of all these complex schemes which enrich a fairly privileged small group of people to solve a problem which can be solved in other ways which are far, far more effective.
Right. Are you keeping track of anything going on in Venezuela and Hugo Chavez, his decree powers that were just given to him by the Venezuelan Assembly? Are you keeping track of any of that?
Strangely enough, I've visited Venezuela, and I visited in 2003, I think, if memory serves me correctly. Though I didn't visit it for professional reasons. I have a fascination for wildlife, and there is a very, very rich area of wildlife called the Llanos in Venezuela. But, you know, Hugo Chavez is basically a couple of things. One is he's obviously a very fierce nationalist in Venezuela, and also he's a fairly autocratic individual. So I'm not surprised to see him seize power and basically try to control that. And, you know, South America has a history of autocratic leaders. It's not anything new. It goes back to Simon Bolivar, really. And so nothing much has changed in that sort of sense. Whether that's good for the country or not, I think, you know, people closer to that are basically going to be able to judge. But certainly it's been very destabilizing for a lot of people.
Right. The law that the name of the law is the enabling law, down in Venezuela. And I seem to recall an enabling act of 1933 that was given to Adolf Hitler.
Indeed, you're right. I think there was something.
And he was given decree powers also. Yeah, Hitler was given decree powers too in 1933 by the German with the Reichstag.
Indeed, if that history is to be drawn parallel, it doesn't terribly give one hope for a great future, does it, George?
No, and in addition to that, he has a new banking law that's going to it has built into the law that they have to give 5% of their profits every 6 months to community groups.
Well, that in some senses is not such a bad, though, you know, Hugo Chavez has a multifaceted personality. One of the things I found when I was in Venezuela, his popularity, particularly among the less fortunate members of society, basically was from the fact that he was making a genuine effort to redistribute wealth. And that's actually quite an interesting point, because one of the issues of debt in places like the United States and so forth has been the fact that incomes, real incomes, for a lot of people in you know, blue-collar work and other forms of work, which are essential to society, essentially have not risen very sharply since the 1970s. In fact, they're about the same as 1970s, which means to maintain living standards or even adequate standards of living, basically people have had to borrow. And so, you know, one of the big problems in terms of effectively Western democratic societies has become the problem of distribution of income. And also, one of the key things that people often forget is America and a lot of Western countries in exporting their productive base, you know, their real economy, the motor car plants, the steel plants, etc., have had huge social consequences of that. Because one famous labor economist once said that what really rolled off General Motors' production line was not so much motor cars as a whole great middle class, which was really at the heart of America in probably the 20th century. And that's been undermined systematically. So those are some of the complex issues that I would like to see people deal with, yet there is, seems to be a deafening silence on some of those issues.
Right. Can you come back for the final segment with us and give some advice?
I might as well, George, I'm here.
Okay. We appreciate it, Dad. We certainly have had a wonderful, insightful interview, and we appreciate you coming back. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. And Charlotte Littlefield's having technical difficulties tonight. Welcome back, Dan. Yeah, welcome back to our program, Dan. All right. Well, we've been talking with Satyajit Das out of Australia. And he's an authority. He's written Traders, Guns, and Money, Knowns and Unknowns, and The Dazzling World of Derivatives. And we just might have lost him, I'm not sure. We're trying to get it back on the air here. Oh, okay. Welcome back, Dad. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, we're having a few difficulties here. We'll see if we can get it back online here. Anyway, he's written this book, and we've been discussing it tonight. He's an expert in the derivatives and risk management of securities. And also, we've touched on a lot of differing kinds of topics, and we got into the protest in London, and we got into touched on them in France. We also talked about the Eurozone And it looks like that that cultural differences between those countries over there is just far and ranging, and it's just too different for them to totally get together. One of the problems that I see and what happened in Greece and in Ireland is that whenever they came into the European Union or the Eurozone and on the financial structure end of it, they did not no longer had their own central banks, and they were using the euro. And whenever they did that, when they had their central banks, they could always inflate their currency by credit creation when they needed to. But after they came and joined into the European Union and started using the euro itself, their central banks no longer were functional, then they couldn't as easily cheat, you could say, or inflate that currency. This is one of the biggest problems that I see. Anyway, God, all kinds of things that have happened. We touched lightly just a few minutes ago about Venezuela, the assembly of Venezuela giving Hugo Chavez decree powers. And the name of that law that they gave him was the Enabling Law. And I recall an Enabling Act that was given to Adolf Hitler in 1933 by the Reichstag, German's parliament at that time. And in that Enabling Act that they gave to Hitler, in addition to the procedure described by the Constitution, laws of the Reich may also be enacted by the governor of the Reich. This includes the laws referred to and so forth. But it gave him decree-making power at that time. And so it was a very big change in Germany from a constitutional government to much more of a dictatorial government by Adolf Hitler. So also in England, my gosh, they're experiencing the biggest snowfall in years, the biggest blizzard. And we had one up there in Minnesota recently that closed us down, and we were unable to broadcast last week. But we had on the air a replay, and I don't know who picked it out, but by gosh, I was very happy with the replay. And that was by, it was a book written by Stephen Kinzer out of Northwestern University. And he wrote a book called Reset Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. And that was a very interesting book in the sense that it put forward onto the table that Iran and Turkey are the new powers in the Middle East. And America's future, we better start becoming awake to what's going on over there. Anyway, we might have someone back on the air now or not. We're still experiencing some. Oh, okay. But anyway, I think Dash is gone. We've had some telephone problems over there from here to Australia. We certainly thank you, Dash, for being with us this evening. We want to thank our crew up there in Minnesota, our engineering crew headed up by Rachel and others, for doing a wonderful job this evening. We have a tremendously changing world. This financial thing, the G20 is trying to create an international financial structure and create a mechanism to put us under their rule of financial rule of law, so to speak. We have people that are fighting back. The states in this country, the individual states, are going out there and saying, we're going to nullify the health bill passed by Obama and his regime. We've got a new Congress coming up next month. This old Congress is still good through January 4th. Reid over in the Senate is swearing that he's going to take the Congress through the end of the year into that January 4th date, all the way to get everything done that he can. There were things that they did not get through. The Dream Act was turned down today in the Senate, and that's dead. The other act concerning whether to declare you're gay or not in the military, it's going to go through. So that's going through right now. Today, it looks like it's going to become law in the near future. The Glass-Steagall Act, we need to reenact it. We need to get the banks out of Wall Street and Wall Street out of the banks, you know. There's a holding company now that the main banks on the eastern seaboard there, Citicorp and all those, are members of. It's a derivative clearinghouse, and they're using that clearinghouse to keep out other banking institutions. It's like a closed-knit type of group of good old boy networks. And that is ongoing still. It's New York-based. It's a big derivative clearinghouse for those major banks and Goldman Sachs and all those banks. It's almost a cookie cutter of the Inter Alpha Bank Group in Europe, which is Rothschild dominated. Tonight, I didn't get to ask Das, who is Indian originally, but living, he was born in Calcutta, but he grew up in Australia there, right outside of Sydney. But I didn't get to ask him. The Rothschild are moving into India aggressively. They see India as a much more fertile investment climate than China. They see China as much more authoritarian, even though they have interests all over. Their concentration seems to be, through their new, one of their new investment vehicles, it seems to be India. So India, to many of the world investors, you could say, or international financiers and investors, is coming into play full force. And you're going to see big, big money put into India to develop the industry even more so than it ever has been. India is a very interesting place right now. It doesn't have much industry. Most of the industry in the Pacific Basin is concentrated in China and some of the surrounding other countries nearby. South Korea has been an industrial force there, and also Japan. But right now, China is the major industrial force in that whole area. India has been more of a service-oriented society. It's agricultural still on a large scale, and it's got a lot of software and internet, web development work being farmed out. It's got service and support, that for many salt companies throughout the world. So they have been more of a service-oriented. I believe the Rothschilds want to go in there. They want to industrialize India and make it more productive. And they're also putting a lot of money in along with Heinz, the vegetable canner, a lot of money into agricultural and to grow a lot more vegetables for, and then canning and exporting those probably back into China and those surrounding Pacific Basin countries. So that's something to watch for right now. The Ron Paul effort is gaining in strength. We need to join in with Ron Paul and wish him luck and give him money, send Campaign for Liberty money. We're going to kick off. We don't know quite the network we'll be affiliated with right now, but it will be a reality. We're going to go on January 10th for sure with a webcast, video, and radio at the same time. And it's going to concentrate out of Austin, Texas, on the Texas legislature. It's going to be 1 hour, 5 to 6. We hope to be in a situation with the Capitol building behind us, out the window. We're working on that now. If we don't, we might go with a green screen behind us and fake it all the way. But anyway, we're going to be close, within walking distance, at one of the two venues that we're looking at, so we can go down there and interact. We're going to be very active with the Tea Party people, Campaign for Liberty, and other people that we welcome that are constitutionalists that want to get this country back to a firm, stable standard of constitutionality, which we far, far left behind years ago. We need to get back there. And wish you happiness for forever and all the week. And have a good weekend tomorrow. Thank you very much. Good night.